Chapter 42. The next day he took an AirPod out to the basin, grateful when no one else had made any overtures about accompanying him. Under other circumstances, he might have put that down to their lack of interest and been suitably offended by it. He doubted that was the case now. Sunday, Jitendra and Jumai knew he had matters of his own to attend to, and they were giving him the privacy he needed. He flew low and fast, trying to empty his mind. It was easier said than done. Though the rains had come in force, greening the land that had been parched in January, he knew the old landmarks too well for it to look truly new. He had put down too much of his life here, scratched too much of his history into the terrain. Every waterhole, every copse of trees, every trail had some personal significance, however slight. He had travelled far, but he hadn't broken the ties to this tiny part of Africa, or the ties hadn't let him escape. He circled his usual study areas, relying on his own eyes to pick out the herds and lone males. It was trickier with the increased tree cover, but he'd had enough practice to be sure of not missing much. He knew the elephants' seasonal movements, their habits and customs and favoured meeting places, and his eyes and brain were attuned to picking out shapes and associations that might have eluded the less experienced. It did not take long to locate Matilda and her clan. They were less than half a K from where he'd assumed they would be, and a quick series of looping inspections established that the M group had suffered no losses since his last survey. Indeed, there were a couple of babies calved while he was away. There had been several pregnancies in the group at the time of his departure, so it wasn't surprising. From the movements of the calves, it was impossible to tell who the mothers had been. The babies ambled playfully from one adult to another, sharing in the overall protection and nurturing environment of the M group. He made one low pass to let the elephants know he was arriving, or that someone was arriving anyway, as they'd normally associate him with a Cessna, not an AirPod, and then selected a landing site within easy range of the group. Thick, lush grass buckled under the AirPod's skis. He opened the canopy and climbed out, grunting as his shoulders protested with the effort. His muscles and bones were still aching after the prolonged period of weightlessness aboard Summer Queen and Lionheart, but not so much that he felt the need of an exo. The day was hot, dry, and windless. There were no clouds, and that was a propitious omen for the scattering. He had learned of the plans and approved of them, although there was still a tiny twinge of doubt at the back of his mind. Memphis had never been one for the attention-seeking gesture, and perhaps he would not entirely approve of the arrangements. But then, if the Akinya family wished to honour him, wasn't that their prerogative? That was for later, though. Jeffrey had other business now. He sealed the AirPod and strode through the undergrowth towards the herd. After a few paces, he found a stick and grabbed it to beat the ground ahead of him. He carried nothing with him, no monitoring equipment, no sports bag stuffed with pencils and paper, just the clothes he had on, which were already beginning to stick to his skin. He had made a mental note to allow himself time to change before they all went out from the household. Sunday wasn't going to get a chance to accuse him of smelling of dung this time. It wasn't the heat making him sweat, though. Jeffrey was nervous. "It's me," he called, as he always did. "Jeffrey, I've come back." He pushed through the trees and bushes, whacking the ground with the stick and calling to announce his approach. From close ahead, he heard the threat rumble of an adult female, and then he made out the humped forms of a couple of outlying herd members. He noted their shapes and ear profiles, recognizing them as individuals. Still whacking the ground and announcing his arrival, he circled around the pair. He leapt a narrow brook and nearly twisted his ankle on landing. The stick had served its purpose, so he threw it away. He crossed behind another stand of trees and found a group of six elephants, with Matilda facing him. Behind the M group matriarch stood Molly and Martha, two high-ranking females, both of whom had scarred foreheads, one tusk missing, and heavily battle-damaged ears. Melissa, the young elephant that Memphis had helped Jeffrey inject with nanomachines, stood between Martha and Molly, her head lowered and eyes brimming with alert watchfulness. Two yet-to-be-named calves moved among the larger elephants. Geoffrey moved into sunlight. He walked slowly, but with all the authority and confidence he could muster. He didn't doubt that the elephants were aware of his fear, broadcast through the chemical medium of his sweat, but at least he could look the part. Matilda broke away from the group, taking a handful of lumbering steps in his direction. She emitted a rumble and flicked dirt with her trunk. Not at him, exactly, but a kind of diagonal warning shot across his bows. There was something dismissive in the gesture, as if he scarcely warranted more effort than that. Geoffrey raised his open hands and stood his ground. Such behaviour wasn't out of character for Matilda. It didn't imply hostile intent, so much as a ritualistic reminder of her status. The way a queen might demand that her courtiers approach the throne bent double and suppliant. The other five elephants had begun to drift back, though their attention was divided equally between Matilda and the human who had interrupted their communal food gathering. Matilda stopped 10 paces from Geoffrey. Her trunk was raised, her forehead wide and powerful as a battering ram. He could hardly see her eyes. "I know what happened," he said, pushing aside thoughts of how absurd it was to be talking to an elephant. These words weren't for Matilda, though. "I did what I'd been fearful to do before. I correlated your movements on the day Memphis died, and I know you were there. I know you were with him." He had meant to end it there, to turn around and return to the airpod. Now that the moment was upon him, though, he knew that he would always regret wasting this final opportunity. He voked the command, opened the Neuralink. Her brain appeared next to his. Two weird, squirming sea sponges, pulsing with blood and heat, and the endless chatter of electrochemical signalling. His own fear centre was already lit up like a football stadium glowing across the night. He wasted no time. Up through the 10s, 20s, 30s, 40%, then 50. Her state of mind subsumed his own, crushing his fear, replacing it with something much closer to annoyance, only slightly tempered by wariness. Up through 60, 70%. Her body image had dismantled his own, distorting his perception of scale. He was huge, but tiny. She was tiny, but huge. At 90%, he allowed the Neuralink to stabilize. He knew what she had done. The mind, dam bursting into his, was the mind of a premeditated and calculating killer. Memphis had been careless, it was true, too much on his mind, and when he went out to do Geoffrey's errands, he hadn't taken the precautions that would normally have been second nature. Above all, he had made the fatal error of trusting Matilda, simply because she had never once shown the slightest intent to harm him. It must have been quick. One day, perhaps, Geoffrey would have the courage to review the record of events captured by her own eyes and those of any other elephants close enough to witness the murder. There'd been several. It didn't really matter, though. He had placed her at the scene of the crime, and that was sufficient. How was the easy part? Memphis had been distracted, and Matilda had closed in on him too quickly for him to react. The org was thin here, the mechanism toothless. Had the mech detected the imminent nature of that violent and terminal act of aggression, it might have done something. But there'd been no time either for the mech to intervene or for Memphis to save himself. The why was more speculative. Geoffrey had a theory, though. Matilda had committed the deed, but the fault was not really hers. She had developed a grudge against Memphis, and given his years of uneventful interaction with the herd, there could only be one explanation for that. Geoffrey had implanted the idea in her head that Memphis was an elephant killer. Because it was true. Because Geoffrey had known that his whole adult life and longer. He had known it since the day Memphis came to rescue Sunday from the hole, the depression in the ground where the Artelect had been washed out of the earth. When they had been making their way back to the airpod, Following a trail through a grove of trees, a bull had blocked their path. Memphis had told Jeffrey to look away, and he had, for a few moments. But he had not been able to resist looking back, thinking that Memphis would never know. And he had seen the fallen bull. It was only later that he had come to a full understanding of what had happened in that confrontation. Memphis had reached into the adult bull's mind and used his human privilege to submit a killing command to its implanted neuromachinery. A whispered death order, one softly voked incantation, and that was all it had taken to bring the bull down. At any other time, Memphis might have risked sending a less lethal command, one that would simply put the elephant to sleep. But he had taken no chances that day. Two children's lives were in his hands. Jeffrey had carried the memory of that day ever since, so much a part of him that he barely noticed it. Memphis had taken no pleasure in the act. He'd done it not because he despised or feared the bull, but because he had an absolute and binding duty of care to the children in his charge that took precedence over all other considerations. He had dispensed death only as a last resort, and to Jeffrey's knowledge, that was the only time Memphis had ever been called upon to kill another creature. Kill rather than stun, so that the bull never troubled another human being. Jeffrey didn't doubt that the act had troubled Memphis in the days that followed. But there had been no witnesses to that act, and the bull had not been part of a herd. Was it really possible that Matilda's decision to kill Memphis could be in any way linked to that incident from Jeffrey's childhood? It wasn't the case that there'd been no witnesses, though. Jeffrey himself had seen what had happened, or its aftermath at least. And years later, he had welcomed Matilda into his head. He thought back to the time when he had allowed the Neuralink to transmit his mental state into hers, letting her share in the pain of the scorpion sting. He had no conscious recollection of associating Memphis with the death of the bull. But had he inadvertently communicated that association to Matilda? Had he, in the opening of his mind, planted the symbolic notion in hers that Memphis killed elephants? He wanted to dismiss the idea as absurd, but the more repellent he found it, the more it kept coming back. It wasn't Memphis's fault for being inattentive. It wasn't even Matilda's for taking defensive action against what she now understood to be a threat. She had her herd to think of, after all. She was only doing right by them. Inescapably, he was forced back to one truth. The fault was his, and his alone. Intentionally or otherwise, Jeffrey had killed Memphis. All at once, the resolve left him. He had intended to push the Neuralink to 100% just this once. But the moment had passed. If that meant he was too timid to follow his own investigations to their logical conclusion, then so be it. "I'm sorry," he said. "I should have known better." He closed the connection and turned back for the AirPod. More visitors had arrived by the time he returned to the household, judging by the AirPods gathered along the parking area. Jumai was waiting for him, already dressed for the scattering. She wore a tight-fitting black jacket and a slim black skirt, offset with flashes of red around the waistline. She brushed a hand against his arm as they met in one of the hallways, lowering her voice to a concerned hush. "How did it go out there?"
"I had some unfinished business," Jeffrey said.
She nodded slowly. "And is it finished now?"
"I think so."
"I'll be heading back to Lagos tomorrow. Not to my old job, but Lagos is still where my contacts are. I'm hoping I might be able to leverage my recent experiences into a new contract, maybe off Earth. Still a lot of stuff out there that needs cleaning up."
"Aren't you fed up with excitement?"
"If you mean, do I want to dodge high-velocity ice packages for the rest of my life? Then the answer's no. But I do need challenges. I certainly got them when I signed up to help you break into the Winter Palace." He smiled tightly.
More than you are counting on, I'm sure. Something's definitely changed. Maybe it's you, maybe it's me.
Jemai looked up and down the hall, holding her tongue, as a proxy strode past.
Not one of the household units, Jeffrey decided.
Look, I'll only say this once. Being here isn't normal for either of us, and I'm not one for funerals at the best of times. But when I get back to Lagos, will you come over and spend a few days? I mean, work permitting.
I'd like that.
I'll hold you to it, all right?
Only then did she drop her hand from his sleeve.
You'd better go and scrub up, rich boy. I'll see you in the courtyard when you're done. Sunday and Jitendra are already there.
I won't be long.
He went to his room, stripped and showered, and was halfway through dressing in clean clothes when his gaze chanced upon the 6 wooden elephants. He'd been too tired and preoccupied to pay any attention to them yesterday.
Why should he?
They were part of the furniture, that was all. The fact that the constructs guarding both the Winter Palace and Lionheart had questioned him about them was neither here nor there. It only meant that the elephants really had been a gift from Eunice, as he had believed at the time. Or rather, from whatever intelligence had been masquerading as his grandmother during all the long years of her imaginary exile. But he realized now that there was rather more to them than that. He sat down on his bed, as momentarily dizzy as if he'd been knocked on the head. It couldn't be, could it? After all this time, so close at hand, so close to his hands.
He picked up the heaviest of the elephants, the bull at the head of the group. Not very plausible given elephants' social dynamics, but he supposed that hadn't really been the point. He stroked the elephant's body, reassuring himself that its composition was what he had always assumed, always been told, some dark, dense wood. It was, he was sure of that. But the base material, that was something else. Heavy and black and irregular, flat along the bottom and top, as if cleaved from some larger, coal-like motherlode. He tipped the piece to look at its base, the elephant upside down, and made out the faint scratch bisecting it from one side to the other. He'd never noticed that scratch before, and even if he had, he'd have had no reason to attach any significance to it. But now he knew. It only took a few moments to confirm that there were similar scratches on the other 5 bases. He knew exactly where they'd come from. Thinking of what they had lost, what they had gained, what was yet at stake, Jeffrey sat sobbing, the bull elephant in his hand, as heavy and cold as stone. Sunday and her brother walked out with the rest of the clan, the family and friends, into the evening air, Lucas with them, Jitendra and Jemai not far away. The sky was pellucid and still, as clear as that long ago evening when they had come to scatter Eunice's ashes. She had not been embodied then, at least not in flesh and blood, but it was hard to dislodge the memory that she had been here, walking on African soil, breathing African air. I have been giving some thought to the matter we discussed over dinner, Lucas said, his voice low enough not to carry more than a few paces. He walked with his back straight and his hands clasped behind his back.
If you want evidence, Sunday said, that's going to be a little difficult, at least for the moment. There's Summer Queen, obviously, but beyond that, you'll just have to take a trip to Lionheart and see the test machinery for yourself. The construct told my brother that it's fully operational.
Summer Queen itself points to new physics, or at least an area of current physics that we only thought we understood, Lucas said. That in itself does lend a certain credibility to the rest of the story. You'll excuse any skepticism on my part, though, I hope. Even if Hector was telling me these things, I'd still want more than mere words. It's difficult enough to accept that our grandmother knew about this new physics. Everything it implies, that But to be asked to believe these things of Memphis? That he was not the man we imagined him to be?
He was old enough not to have a past fixed in place by the mech or posterity engines, Geoffrey said.
I admit that there are absences in his biography, but no more so than would be the case in a million people of his age.
Lucas touched a hand to his mouth, coughing under his breath.
And there was once a physics student with a similar name, born in Tanzania at about the right time.
Then you accept that there's at least the possibility this is all true,
Sunday said.
It would help if there was something more. I believe what Geoffrey and Jemai have told me, and I also believe what you have told me about your exploits on Mars. I saw some of that for myself, remember? Even if it wasn't through my own eyes.
Sunday flinched at the recollection of Lucas's ruined face, the dislodged eyeball, the milky eruption of the proxy's slick, wet innards.
Might I interrupt?
The girl asking the question was someone Sunday had seen before, under similar circumstances. She was even wearing the same red dress, the same stockings and black shoes, the same hairstyle. Out of curiosity, Sunday requested an org tag. The girl was a golem, although the point of origin of the Chingbind couldn't be resolved.
You're Lynn.
Of course, the girl said. I knew your grandmother.
Geoffrey sneered. After what happened on Mars, I'm surprised you'd show your face.
Did I cross you personally?
She asked, shooting a sharp stare at him from under her straight black fringe. You never got the chance, Geoffrey said.
If I had something to be ashamed of, do you think I'd have bothered introducing myself? What happened on Mars was not my concern, and I wouldn't have approved it had I known. As it transpires, the gesture achieved nothing.
Charmand Gleb told me there was a rift,
Sunday said.
The Mandala discovery has only stressed fault lines that were already present,
Lin Wei said.
I think the world has the right to know that we've found evidence of alien intelligence on another world, and that it shouldn't have to wait until that data seeps into the public domain. Some of my colleagues have a different view. If I'm feeling charitable, it's because they don't think the rest of humanity is quite ready for such a shattering revelation. In my less charitable moments, it's because they don't want to share their secret with anyone.
I can't help you, Geoffrey said.
The data will be made public sooner or later,
Lin Wei said, unconcernedly, as if his help didn't matter one way or the other.
I've put in measures to ensure that happens. Naturally, I have my critics, even enemies. Some of them are going to make life very interesting for me in the coming years. But that's not a bad thing. At least I won't be bored. I was ready to leave Tiamat long before you gave me an excuse, Geoffrey. But I thank you for providing the spur.
She paused.
I've a gift for you. But you'll have to come and get it. It would be far too bothersome to bring it back down to Earth again.
Sunday searched her brother's face for clues. Geoffrey looked none the wiser.
You don't owe me any gifts, Arethusa.
Oh, all right then.
She wrinkled her nose in irritation.
Call it return goods. Your little aeroplane, Geoffrey. It was retrieved from the sea when the Nevsky rescued you.
What was that, Sunday wondered, but a sly reminder of the debt he owed her.
In all the fuss, it ended up being loaded aboard the heavy lift rocket. I've had it cleaned and repaired, and it's yours to take back whenever you like.
What's the catch?
None. Other than that, you'll have to visit one of our orbital leaseholds to retrieve it, but there'll be no diplomatic complications. You are, after all, still a citizen of the United Aquatic Nations.
Sunday frowned, wondering exactly what she meant by that. There was still a lot she needed to talk about with her brother. She supposed there would be plenty of time in the days to come.
Thank you for saving the Cessna, he said.
It was the least I could do. Well, almost the least. There's one other.
But he cut her off. You can take a message to Charmer and Gleb for me. Will you do that?
Naturally.
Thank them for helping Sunday while I was away. And tell them that the elephant work can continue. I have no objection to the establishment of a linked community. The Amboseli herds and the Lunar Dwarves. They can share the same sensorium, the way Charmer and Gleb planned. I'll be glad to provide any technical assistance.
I think they'll be looking for more than just assistance,
Sunday said.
Full collaboration, a shared enterprise.
Then they've come to the wrong man. He walked on for a few more paces before elaborating. I don't work with elephants anymore. That was something I used to do. Sunday could hardly believe what she was hearing. But she knew Jeffrey well enough to be certain that he wasn't just saying that for dramatic effect, expecting everyone to put an arm around him and tell him how wonderfully important his work was, how he was undervalued and underappreciated, how he owed it to the elephants to keep on with the studies. She'd had that conversation often enough in the past. This wasn't it.
You're serious?
He nodded, but not with any sense of triumph. I think we both have enough to keep us busy, don't you? Lin Wei, to her credit, did not question Jeffrey's sincerity. Perhaps it was just an outburst, something he'd retract in the days to come, but everything in her brother's manner said otherwise.
Charmer and Gleb will be sorry. I know they were looking forward to your involvement.
They're smart enough to manage without me. It was always the elephants they wanted, not the researcher. Lin Wei said,
I don't think it's very long to the scattering now.
She made a gesture in the air, shaping a square, and the org filled the square with darkness.
Can you all see this?
They were still walking, but the square moved with them. One by one, they confirmed that they were able to see it.
Sunday told Charmer and Gleb about the numbers, and they in turn told me,
Lin Wei went on.
The numbers wouldn't have meant much to an outsider, but their meaning was immediately clear to me, as they would have been to Eunice.
So what do they mean?
Sunday asked. The rectangle dappled itself with smudges of milky light.
Ocular pointing coordinates, Lin Wei said. That's what they are, a set of directions for the instrument. Before very long, my adversaries will make it very difficult for me to access Ocular, but for the moment, that is still my privilege. As well it should be, given that I conceived and birthed it. Needless to say, I did not hesitate to abuse that privilege by ordering Arachne to point Ocular in the direction corresponding to the coordinates.
Mandala? Jeffrey asked.
No. Crucible lies in the constellation Virgo, and this is in the direction of Lyra, a completely different part of the sky, close to Altair, in fact, one of the stars of the summer triangle. Arachne's search algorithms eliminated any star-like objects from the immediate center of the field, but you'll note that there is still something there.
What is it?
Sunday asked.
I thought perhaps you might be able to tell me, given what the two of you have learned of your grandmother. It's incredibly faint, and at first glance, it appears quasar-like, but it's not a quasar. It's a... Well, I don't know. Neither does Arachne. She's seen billions of astronomical objects, but nothing that looks remotely like this energy source. That's what it is, an energy source. Highly Dopplered, we can tell from the spectrum, moving away from us along what appears to be a radio line of sight. We'll have a better handle on it as time goes by if we pick up lateral motion, but I don't think we will. I think we will find that this thing, this object, started off in the solar system about 60 years ago. And ever since then, it's been rushing away from us, falling into the summer stars.
Jeffrey asked, how far out is it now?
Lin Wei's smile was impish. I think I've given you enough to be going on with, don't you? Let's just say it's a long, long way, further than any human artifact has ever reached, and traveling at quite a ridiculous speed.
To nowhere in particular?
Sunday probed.
There's no star along that exact line of sight?
There are stars, to be sure, but none that strike us, Arachne or myself, as an obvious candidate.
Lin Wei made a flicking gesture, and the image disappeared.
That's all you're going to give us?
Sunday asked.
For now? You want more? Come and talk to me. I think we all have rather a lot to discuss. Don't you?
She's in that thing,
Jeffrey said. That's what you think.
That Eunice is in a ship. A ship that's been heading away from Earth for 60 years.
She spoke to me once,
Sunday replied,
about how it would feel to just keep going, to never go home again.
She paused, trying to call her grandmother's exact words to mind.
Until Earth was just a blue memory. What I didn't realize was, she meant to do it.
She could still be,
Jeffrey began, but he caught himself before the sentence was out. Sunday nodded. He didn't need to say what he was thinking. She was thinking the same thing herself. She supposed the only way to know for sure would be to go out there, to catch up with that impossibly distant thing and see what was inside it. A sleeping lion, perhaps. Senge Dongma. Jitendra said,
I think it's time.
He was right, too. Sunday could feel the ground rumbling under them as the blowpipe sent its tiny package racing under the planes. As one, they turned to face east. As if of its own volition, her hand rose to her neck, fingering the charm she had been given on Mars, binding her to the past, binding her to the future. They watched the spark rise from the mountain, a tiny, bright star, climbing against the turn of the heavens. It was traveling ballistically now, carried on the momentum it had gained in the long acceleration as it rode the magnetic catapult. Some of that momentum was already ebbing. The package was encountering atmospheric resistance, albeit from air that was half as thick as at ground level, and gravity was beginning to reassert its claim. Ordinarily, the launch lasers would have cut in by now, projecting their ferocious energies onto the underside of the package to give it that extra push into orbit. Some of the onlookers, Sunday felt certain, must already have come to the conclusion that the blowpipe had mistimed. Others, she felt equally sure, were entirely ignorant of the usual mechanics. The star kept rising. From the party's vantage point, it appeared to be climbing vertically, but it was in fact following an arc, one that was already taking it east, out towards the Indian Ocean. Just when it looked on the point of falling, though, the lasers shone. Their beams scratched diamond-bright tracks in the sky, converging from Kilimanjaro's summit to meet at a fixed focus point in space, where the air became a little ball of ionized hell. The focus would ordinarily have been immediately underneath the rising object, but the arrangements were different today. The lasers were now directing their energies directly ahead of the package. It had no protection against that. It had been designed to be pushed, not to hit that plasma head-on, with no frontal shielding beyond that necessary to withstand the aerodynamic stresses. The effect on the package was rapid and glorious. The star's brightness flared by sudden magnitudes until it looked as if a new day was dawning. Sunday raised her fingers against the dazzle, catching greens and pinks in the tiny blazing point. The light fluttered, and then, as quickly as it had begun, that little new sun began to break up, oozing molten droplets of itself. The colors subsided, gold turning to amber, amber to orange, orange to a slow, dulling red. She tried to trace the falling sparks, but they were soon lost in the glow of the sky. She knew the truth of it, that if any part of him was to rain down from that pyre, it would happen far out at sea. And perhaps no part had survived that incandescence.
But from where Sunday was standing, from where everyone now stood, it was hard not to believe that some part of their friend and mentor would end up touching the summit of that mountain, end up touching the snows of Kilimanjaro. And that was enough. We spoke of beginnings at the start of this. It is well now to speak of endings. That was the last that Geoffrey had to do with Matilda or the M-Clan, or the Amboseli herds, or elephants in general, or at least the last that any of us ever knew about. There was a sadness at first, then anger and remorse, mingled with lingering self-disgust at what he believed he had caused to happen. Then just sadness again, long and slow dying, like the endless collapsing roll of thunder across the plains. He could not have known, of course, and it took years before he was even ready to speak of what had happened on the day when Matilda saw too deeply into his head and understood Memphis for what he was, enemy of her kind, murderer of elephants. Even though Memphis had done it for no other reason than to protect us. But she could not see that. She was just an animal after all, no matter how brightly her mind shone. They're still out there, the Phyletic Dwarves. There's no harm in disclosing this information now. We don't know where they are, and in all likelihood, neither do the Orthodox Pans. After the sundering, after the great parting of ways between Truro and Arethusa, Charma and Gleb took their work deeper underground than it had been before. But somewhere out there, in a solar system still big enough to contain hiding places and dark corners, still big enough for secrets, the elephants thrive. Once in a while, conveyed to us through a labyrinth of quangle paths, all but untraceable, we hear from the zookeepers. They are still happily married, and the great work continues. The elephants are doing well. One day, we may yet be a part of it. Data packets still bind the dwarves to the M-Clan, providing that essential socializing framework. But please do not go trying to follow that thread. It'll get you nowhere. Besides, the bonds between the herds are much weaker now than they were when all this started. 20 years on, the dwarves have grandchildren of their own. Sons and daughters and matriarchs and bulls, family ties, the foundation of a complex, self-sustaining elephant society. One day, when resources allow, they may even be allowed to grow, to stop being dwarves. But perhaps that is for another century. If Geoffrey misses his role in that enterprise, he is careful not to show it. No more, perhaps, than Sunday misses her former career as an artist. Or Lucas misses his as a willing component in the family machine. We have all had other business to keep hands, hearts, and minds occupied. Sunday returned to the de-scrutinized zone, and for a little while, she tried to submerge herself in the routines of her old life. She went back to the commissions she had abandoned before her journey to Mars. Jitendra, too, tried to pick up the pieces of his former existence. But it was hard. They both carried too much knowledge, burning in their heads like a lit fuse. We all did. For years, Sunday had worked to bring the Eunice construct to fruition. That private project had been the mainspring of her life, the thing she cared about beyond any of her tiring, rent-paying commissions. She had abandoned physical sculpture in preference for the sculpting of a single human life in all its dizzying fractal glory. And she had not failed. But the construct had grown too clever, too complex. It had torn itself free of Sunday's plans, become something she could influence but not control. And although Geoffrey and Jemai had tried to shield her from the truth, she had made the necessary deductions for herself. The art elect running Lionheart was everything she had ever hoped her construct might become. The work she strove to complete had already been achieved. The construct abides. Like the dwarves, it is out there somewhere, being a bodiless spirit haunting the org. There would be even less point in trying to pin it down. We long ago assigned it all the autonomy it craved. Once in a while we hear from it. Perhaps it thinks of the woman in whose shadow it walks, the figure it can emulate but never become. Perhaps it is content to become something else entirely. Sometimes, when it offers us wise counsel, when it advises us on the intentions of those who would act against us, we are grateful that it is on our side. At other times, we slightly fear it. And sometimes we forget that Eunice is an it, not a she. Of the real Eunice, the living woman, our dead grandmother, things are simpler. At least we know where she is now. There will, of course, be those who criticize us for waiting as long as we did before making this decision. What choice did we have, though? When this burden was placed on us, we were, to be frank, little better than children. We needed time to think, time to judge the readiness of the world. Eunice could not make this decision 60 years earlier. We could not make it rashly either. We wished to see how the world would adapt to the new engines and the knowledge of Mandala. It's been 20 years, but now we are ready. This testimony, written in our shared hand as honestly as we are able, is our attempt at explaining ourselves. We did not go looking for this responsibility, but we have done our best to measure up to it. Looking back across these years, at the way we were then, all our enmities are matters of vanishing consequence, the squabbling of infants. We have moved beyond such things. If nothing else, we owed it to Hector and Memphis to rise above our former selves. Because if we couldn't do it, if we couldn't put aside the past, what hope could there be for anyone else? 20 years ago, the world saw a glimpse of what lay ahead. The improved engines have shrunk the inner solar system, brought Jupiter and Saturn closer, and accelerated the development and colonization of trans-Neptunian space. There have been accidents and stupidities, but for the most part, the technology has been absorbed without catastrophe. As well it should have been, for what we gave you then was really nothing at all. The real test of our collective wisdom begins here and now. We call it the Chibesa Principle. The improved engines were merely a glimpse of what this new physics can give us. Properly tamed, the Chibesa Principle will not only shrink the solar system even further, it will put human starflight within our reach. But understand the risk as well as the promise. Like the discovery of fire, this is not something that can be uninvented. And in the wrong hands, used maliciously or foolishly, the Chibesa Principle is fully capable of murdering worlds. That is why our grandmother deemed us unready. But that was more than 80 years ago, and much has changed since then. We think things are different now, and that the species is ready to demonstrate its collective wisdom. If we are wrong, if our wisdom is lacking, the Chibesa Principle will burn us. And if that's the case, and if there is anyone left to cast judgment on our actions, we shall gladly accept history's verdict. But if we are right, it will give us everything that Soya Akinya showed her daughter when she held her up in the velvet warmth of a Serengeti night. All these stars, all these tiny diamond lights. We have been clever, and on occasion we have been foolish. For smart monkeys, we can, when the mood takes us, be exceedingly stupid. But it was cleverness that brought us to this point, and it is only cleverness that will serve us from now on. We have no time for anything else. You have been listening to Blue Remembered Earth by Alistair Reynolds, read by Cobbina Holdbrook-Smith. It is an Orion Audiobooks production. Copyright Orion Publishing 2011. Recording, music, and production by Peter Rinney.